Are you comfortable sitting that way?
Yeah. Is this how I'm supposed to be?
No, you do whatever you want to. So no, you don't have to. So if you
no, like way. Yeah, like facing you better. It's easier. I don't have to give you the side eye.
The side, like the side profile. Hey, I noticed on your Facebook you don't have picture of yourself.
Oh, you yeah, I made it
profile picture of some piece of art or something.
I made it black 2 years ago when there was a week where 3 black children had been murdered, and then just left it black ever since then because I felt like, okay, well, I'll change it back to something beautiful or some art once this is less of a problem.
Oh, it's going to stay black for a long time.
Yeah, and so then be it. It's the consciousness of our culture.
No, okay, I got so much to go. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the Hump Day Podcast. My name is Pastor Kevin Robertson. It is February 22nd, 2017. Now, I am excited. In fact, I'm more excited because I'm going to enjoy this podcast. I'm interviewing Corey Shaw. Now, Corey's been coming to our church. How long have you been coming to our church?
I'd say we're probably going on 5 years.
5 years? Now, how'd you find the church?
My wife had a friend who went here, and we had been checking out a couple churches around town and not really finding the right fit.
Okay.
And then we came here on her suggestion and immediately fell in love with the crazy pastor and the amazing congregation.
So our first time with lunch was just up the street here at this little Mexican. Do you remember that? Was it a little Mexican restaurant or just...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was the first time, and yep. I was fascinated with you. And so this is where I wanted to kind of go with this interview. Tell us about your childhood, where you were born, your family, and... Because people want to know where your craziness came from.
Yeah.
And usually, I believe we're crazy because of our childhood.
Definitely.
So tell us about that.
So, yeah, my childhood, I grew up on the East Coast. I was born in Massachusetts, in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is the western part of the state. It's a super liberal area. There's 5 colleges in the one town, Amherst College,
okay.
University of Massachusetts, Smith College, which is an all-women's college, Hampshire College, and a couple other ones. So I was born in this area that was very liberal, and was sort of a little bit different than everywhere else.
Okay.
People were, you know, very hippie-like,
mm-hmm.
Sort of East Coast, you know.
Were your parents hippies?
You know, they were both, came from blue-collar families okay. in the eastern part of Massachusetts, and they went to college at UMass, which was in Amherst, and they met there, and they were both very much into the hippie movement at that time. Which, you know, had my dad with super long hair and a beard down to his chest.
So they were
and
typical hippies with a Volkswagen bug.
The whole nine.
Not the bug, the bus.
Yeah, the bus. The whole nine, exactly okay. how you would picture it. And they met in college and basically within 2 years had my brother,
okay.
who was 4 years older than me.
All right.
And so they decided that they were, you know, going to stop going to school and start raising this family. My brother Jake, and they moved to a place that was about 20 minutes away from where the college was and sort of where civilization was.
Okay.
And they moved to a town called Wendell, which is a very unique town with a population of less than 1,000. And it's pretty much, you know, a wide mix of various types of hippies and sort of counterculture people, Rastafarians and Buddhists. You know, there's a Buddhist camp and just sort of all these different fringe of society, people that didn't want to be a part of, you know, even a small town or, you know, much civilization at all. And everybody buys a lot of land and sort of builds their own funky house.
So they lived totally off the grid.
Yeah, they started off, you know, when my brother was born, it was a one-room house that my father had built. He's
okay.
a carpenter
right.
By trade. And
just
so
like Jesus.
And so he built, you know, they bought a whole bunch of acreage
okay.
Down a dirt road, and there was no electricity at first. And they built a one-room house and had my brother, and then he just sort of kept adding on to that house until it became same 2 or 3 rooms, but there was no bathroom in there. It was outhouse.
Really?
And this is Western Massachusetts, so it's not uncommon to get 1.5 feet of snow overnight. Oh, you know, and you're going out to the outhouse.
So this was probably in the early 70s, I assume, when you were born?
Yeah, I was born in 75. Okay. My brother was born in 71.
Okay, so if you were born in 75 and he was born in 71 and you didn't have indoor plumbing, you would assume that's for the homes in the 30s and 40s, maybe.
Right.
But not 1974 or 75.
Yeah, it's definitely a town where time stood still. And, you know, there was even very old colonial houses there. And, you know, it had a colonial history and sort of that whole, you know, East Coast thing. And so there were people that were living in very much that way,
right.
You know, and everyone was heating their houses with wood stoves and not a lot of people had power. And so it was a town full of people that all sort of thought like that.
Okay.
And wanted the freedom to be as weird and raise their family or build their house or do whatever they wanted
to do. So you grew up in that kind of hippie culture of no structure. I would assume your parents had some type of structure raising you guys.
You know, I was brought up in a way that, because of the people and the kids I was around, seemed very normal. But once I got out and away from that town and that way of thinking, you know, there was hippies raised their children in a very different way, right, than a normal, you know, set of parents do. So I called them by their first names. Instead of mom and dad, it was, you know, and it wasn't that we were friends and they were trying to create that sort of my child's my friend thing, but it was, they just didn't want to accept all the norms of society that were, you know, put on even that relationship of parent and child. And
so you grew up in this.
There wasn't a lot of structure. There was, you know, a lot of lead by example and, you know, and sort of seeing hard work, but I was never talked about anything religious. We never were taught about God. We didn't have, compared to a lot of people, a lot of structure. They both were working all the time, so we were latchkey kids,
right,
who would sort of, you know, let ourselves and entertain ourselves, right, at home. And, you know, so I kind of grew up with very little structure in a way, but the structure that was there was basically how to be a good person, okay, and sort of, you know, things that I'm later finding in the Bible, but my parents, who weren't really religious, just sort of, you know, natural how to be a good human,
right,
type of stuff.
So all through elementary, junior high, and high school, you lived in this 4-room house, or what?
Yeah. So once I was born, my dad bought a big parcel of land next door to the first shack. Realized that he couldn't have 2 children in that house with, you know, without running water and all this stuff. So they began to build, just my father and my mother and their friends, a giant house that was had a finished basement, 2 stories, and a finished attic. So it was a huge, you know, 4-bedroom giant house that was really nice and had electricity, and we sort of stepped into
like the Beverly Hills Village.
Yeah.
We just discovered oil.
Yeah. So we had running water, and, you know, we had a well that, you know, that would occasionally run out of water, but most of the time wouldn't, and we had electricity and eventually, you know, television.
When
I was born is when we moved in. I think I was 2 when that house was finished.
Okay.
And they sold the house next store, and then we were in the bigger house.
Okay.
And that, you know, lasted until I was about, I think, 11, and my parents got divorced. And so my childhood was, you know, was crazy for a few different reasons. Obviously, the environment abnormal to most. And then also just the situation at home wasn't great.
Right.
You know, there was lots of fighting and arguing and sort of violence and that sort of thing. So when a lot of people, parents divorce, it sort of devastates the kids.
Yeah.
And even at 11, people would ask me, you know, how do you feel about that? And I'd be like, man, I feel so good. Like, I was just already aware that it was a crazy environment.
Right.
And any, you know, even when you would ask me at that age, I was like, yeah, I'm really happy. Like, it's just, you know, it's not fun to be around people that are fighting.
Because most children I hear that try to be the peacemakers between the parents, you know, did you do that too?
You know, it was really so crazy that it was sort of beyond my control.
Okay.
By the time I came aware of what was going on, it was already way too intense for me, even as a child, to sort of fathom. Okay. making a piece, really. Right. It was.
So you were having your brother was probably 16,
yeah,
15 years old, I would guess.
Yeah.
So you were going, okay, thank God they're divorced. Okay, maybe we'll have peace. You end up living with which parent?
I stayed with my mom, and my brother went. And my brother at that time was going through a lot of stuff that kids his age shouldn't, you know, normally go through, and he was having a hard time, so he had dropped out of school at that age and went and lived with my father and was sort of no supervision.
Okay.
And I stayed with my mom, you know, and she did a great job as a single mom from then until I left, you know, really being focused on me and raising me and doing what she could, but she was still a single mom, so it was still that element of really no supervision, kind of left to my own devices, and they didn't really have too many options of how to, we didn't have a big family. There wasn't aunts and uncles. It was really just sort of like isolated in this small town still. And
okay. So the big Christmas movies weren't realistic.
Yeah, none of that.
Families getting together and singing Christmas carols around the piano. So, okay. Now you got into skateboarding.
Right around that time.
Okay. Now to me, I've tried skateboarding. I cannot balance on a skateboard. I cannot do it. It takes coordination.
Yeah.
But apparently you can, or you did.
Yeah,
so tell us about your skateboard.
Yeah, the skateboarding came around that time. I was around 11 years old and around when they were getting divorced. And I was heavy into martial arts before that. That was sort of like my first big passion. And for years, you know, and going to classes every day. And, you know, I was going to be ninja, you know. And so it was Taekwondo class, which is a Korean form. And I was just, that was it.
Right.
And then when I discovered skateboarding, I sort of felt like it was all the things that I liked about jumping and flying around.
Right.
And, you know, and sort of the extreme nature of martial arts was present in skateboarding, but it felt like just a lot more fun. There was just sort of nothing could beat that first feeling of being able to roll on the thing and stay on it and make it turn, and I was sort of hooked from then, and it was a small thing back then. It wasn't a giant industry. There weren't skate parks everywhere. It was illegal everywhere, and I lived on a dirt road in the middle of the woods.
Skateboarding.
So yeah, so the skateboarding led my mom to realize that, you know, it wasn't healthy for a teenager, after seeing what happened with my brother, to be so isolated and in this sort of strange community, way removed from everyone else.
Right.
And obviously the skateboarding thing, I needed to be in, you know, a more urban area, and I needed concrete.
Right.
So she moved to the town where my mom and dad had met, which was Amherst, which is the University of Massachusetts and Amherst College, and that whole thing, which is, you know, still a small town, but had, you know, all kinds of sort of a playground of skateboarding and people that were, you know, not just hippies.
Right. And now, how did you know that I am better than the typical skateboarder, that I could make something into this, I can do something out of this?
Well, I definitely didn't. I just loved it so much that I became obsessed with learning it. It was something that, you know, had all these different tricks, the same way within martial arts, it was all these different kicks and moves.
Right.
I was sort of like, wow, there's all these different, you know, tricks and things that I could do. So I just got obsessed with like the infinite nature of trying to learn this thing. And I didn't know if I was good or not.
Right.
And it took, you know, it's the rule of 30,000 hours or whatever that saying is, where it was, I just sort of became obsessed, where it was every day, it's all I wanted to do. And, you know, it was one of those things where you could progress really fast, where one day you could learn one thing and the next day you could learn two. And so I saw and felt this progression, and I just sort of it fit my personality of being alone and not having to rely on anybody else to be there.
Right.
Whereas like soccer or football or baseball, you need a team. There's a coach, you know, there's people telling you what to do, which obviously I didn't grow up with a lot of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, it just appealed to me in all these ways that I just became obsessed with doing it.
Right.
Found a group of friends that, you know, were also sort of the same way. And
obsessed.
And then we had no real coverage. California was the Mecca, and that's where everybody was. So we almost didn't know. We would see something in a magazine and think, everybody in California was doing that amazing thing, and they were doing it every time they tried it. And so we would sort of have this illusion of what it was like out here that would make us actually go out and learn that impossible trick that the guy didn't even land, that they just got one photo of. And we would actually wind up doing it, learning it so good that we could do it every time because we thought that's what they were doing. Yeah. And so it's sort of the disconnect from the whole culture made us all become really good in a bubble. And then when California sort of discovered all of us on the East Coast, it was like, whoa.
Well, let me end on that, because let me open this up a little. So you had a group of people, and it's interesting to me that you were saying my life when I was brought up was very undisciplined, but you grow, you're addicted to martial arts, which is very disciplined, and the skateboarding is very disciplined. So somehow you were attracted to discipline.
Yes.
And
knowing that I had to come from me.
Yeah.
Because no one else was trying to give it to me. So, yeah, I think I was attracted to anything that would sort of help me, you know, focus, have parameters, accountability.
Absolutely. So, and for an 11-year-old child or a 13-year-old child, that's big to discover, okay, I need to be disciplined. So somehow a bunch of your...
And I had a family all of a sudden. You know, the way they talk about gang culture where without really a family, the gang is sort of, you know, it's like the skateboarding thing back then. We were so close-knit that it was... I instantly had this sort of gang slash family of kids that were also marginalized from their families or culture or whatever.
That's a good point. So in a sense, you guys were brothers.
Yeah, very much. So, we became the, you know, friends as blood.
Right. So how in the world did you get discovered?
The discovery thing was, you know, there was a couple photographers that would take pictures, but there really wasn't any other way except every year they would have this trade show in Atlantic City, New Jersey, which is, man, in the 80s was one of the most unsavory places you could ever go. But, you know, there was a degree of my mom wasn't foolish, but I was also a little bit manipulative where I would say, you know, Ma, we're going to go to Boston, which was a common thing for us to drive 2 hours, stay with friends in Boston and skateboard all over the city.
Yeah.
And really, I'd be going on an Amtrak train to Atlantic City, New Jersey with a bunch of guys to go to this thing. And so she didn't always know every last thing that I was doing. She trusted the group of friends. All my friends were usually, you know, much older than me.
Okay.
So I was like the little guy that was really good amongst a bunch of much older guys. So they would always look out for me. So she trusted that wherever I was going with them, I would be, you know, for being so young and so little, I would be taken care of. But we would go to this thing, and it was, you know, a small handful of these companies, skateboard companies, clothing companies, surf companies, that would go to this trade show, set up their booths, and make orders for the year at all the small stores that would sell it. So we would go to that, and we would have these VHS tapes of that we would film of each other doing our tricks.
Right.
And we would, you know, sort of crudely edit them together with two VCRs and hitting pause and just, you know, do whatever we had to do back then with these giant, horrible cameras. And and we would put these tapes together, and I would make 5 or 6 of them, and I would go and just go to a company and give it to them and say, this is what I can do.
Okay.
Let me know if you want to send me free product. And whatever, you know, I can do tours and demonstrations and sort of be the face of your brand. And that was sort of a common thing back then.
How old were you then?
Man, when I started doing that, I was 14.
Okay, that is smart marketing.
Yeah.
I mean, for a 14-year-old.
Well, I had the guidance of this sort of 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds.
I mean, still. I mean, that's incredible. Let me ask you this. I'm fascinated with this. What was your biggest trick that you could do that just was, like, the selling point?
You know, I was, back then, I'm trying to, because that was in the beginning. And
you
there
probably
was,
can't do it now, but, I mean, back then when you were...
I would skate the big ramps. I was a really tiny kid at 14. Okay. I hadn't had a growth spurt yet, so I would skate the big, giant half pipes. And I could do, you know, airs on those and 360 airs and, you know, and a lot of little kids couldn't even get up to the top. And so I was able to do, you know, sort of skate like the adults, even though I was really tiny. So for me, I'm trying to remember back then, it's like there wasn't that many tricks. There's a lot of iterations of me making these tapes and sort of getting these sponsors or whatever.
But for your size and for your age, I mean, you were good.
Yeah. Yeah. It was sort of like, you know, wow, look at the little guy.
Okay. So then you guys, did you get a sponsor then?
Yeah, and so this is where my life starts getting sort of, you know, I'm following a path and I'm following something that's in my head and, right. and sort of this vision of what I want to do. But there starts to be sort of these synchronicities or just these events that enable me to do things that are really unexplainable and just feel like grace,
oh, okay.
you know, and I just don't understand. And at the time I didn't necessarily believe in God. I didn't really know about spiritual things.
Right.
You know, I was just following my heart,
right.
you know, and following this thing. But, I would give, you know, I gave the tape to this one company that was located in the Bay Area, and they, you know, he just instantly wanted an East Coast skateboarder.
Right.
We were starting to get notoriety,
okay.
and sort of all these California companies were like, well, I want one of those
right.
East Coast guys too. You know, they have a different edge and mm-hmm. and sort of style, and they do it, they go really fast, and you know, and, mm-hmm. and sort of a different approach
okay.
than California, which was a little more surfer laid back.
Right, right.
We were sort of like, you know,
yes.
you know how New Yorkers are. It's like we can't even drive a car without screaming at everybody. So that was sort of our within our style of
right,
how
right.
we would even do a skateboard.
Like
it was
angry,
angry, aggressive.
Yeah.
You know, we only have 6 months to do it because of the snow.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
Know, so we're you know, and we're doing it in the snow, and we're falling on the frozen ground and getting more
that's
angry.
Hardcore.
Yeah, so we had this sort of hardcore approach, and so they all wanted, you know, maybe somebody like
right.
that to represent their
yeah.
company on the East Coast and bring awareness to their thing. And so I got with this one company, and this is when I was 14, and they said, okay, well, next year we want to fly you out to California and have you come out for the whole summer, because I was still in school.
Right.
So your whole summer vacation, you're going to tour and be with us, and we're going to take photos and film
at 15 years
and do the whole thing. And so I was like, great, you know, that's mm-hmm. amazing. And I had already done a little bit of touring with
right.
some other companies
right.
and contests and all that sort of stuff, so I was, you know, sort of familiar with it. But it was my first time to
right.
California
yeah.
to do the big thing. And so at the same time, I was always an artist. So skateboarding was my thing, and it's all I cared
yeah.
about. And, you know, when my guidance counselor asked me why I was, you know, a fairly smart kid with horrible grades and did great on the SAT but didn't want to go to college,
right.
my response was, well, I'm going to be a pro skateboarder.
Right.
And so, you know, all that can wait. I can do that after, you know, my intelligence isn't going to disappear.
Right.
You know, so I can come back and go to college.
Okay.
And I just sort of felt like even back then, I was just like, I have this very, you know, this mission.
This,
I have this dream
mission,
and this vision,
yeah.
and I seem to have some amount of talent within it, and I seem to have people that want to support it.
Right.
So that was sort of, you know, the only focus. So, but art was always there, because within skateboarding, there's the graphics on the skateboard
right.
and the t-shirts and the logos and
right.
the magazines. And so it was sort of a big part of why I liked this one and not
right.
that one.
Right.
And, you know, so I was, you know, into art, but it was sort of, you know, a background thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would do graffiti, because we would go to these skateboard places that were covered in, you know, graffiti, and I would want to add my name to it. Or
mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a serious thing. It was just sort of something that we all did,
mm-hmm.
you know, tag our name at a skateboard spot in the
yeah.
city, or, you know, and practice sort of graffiti things
right.
just for fun.
Yeah.
But I gave a couple of them to this company, and they were like, wow, it's sort of like your art looks like the way that you guys are,
yeah.
which is all different than our California artists.
Right.
Your stuff feels aggressive and a little bit more street oriented, and, you know, it feels East Coast. So
right.
he started having me give artwork that they started, you know, putting into the clothing line.
So you became a very good graffiti artist.
I wasn't even that good. I don't know why he believed in me, you know.
Well, he,
like,
thought you were good.
He thought I was
okay.
good. You know, and then interestingly enough, I had written him, I had done a drawing and gave it to him, and he liked it, but
right.
there was a note attached to the drawing, a handwritten note, where I was just sort of saying, hey, what's up, you know, just, I thought you guys might like this, maybe
yeah.
we could make some shirts with this,
right.
and that was hanging up behind him. And then, for whatever reason, he wound up becoming partnered with Ice-T, the rapper slash actor.
Okay. Yeah, right.
And so then him and Ice-T created a clothing line, and Ice-T happened to be in his office, looked at the wall behind him and said, what is that writing on that note behind you?
So he saw the note that you
yeah.
wrote on them. Okay.
And so he goes, oh, it's this little kid that we met, you know, at the trade show, that's a skateboarder
yeah.
that's, you know, doing, that's just sending in art or whatever.
Right.
And you just want me that note. And he was like, that's what I want. Ice-T just pointed at it and said, that's what I want for my new clothing line. I want his writing.
So
I just want his handwriting to be the logo, to be the everything.
So at 15 years old.
Yes. Still in high school.
Ice-T's clothing line focus and says, I like this dude's writing, whoever he is. And they even said he's 15.
Yeah, and so they hired, and then he said he's still in high school, and he said, I don't care, he can still do it. So they made me the art director while I was, you know, a junior in high school for Ice-T's clothing line, which was called Original Gangster Gear.
Okay, that's crazy. Not only, so now you're in skateboarding, now you're hired by Ice-T's clothing line.
Yep.
As a junior in high school.
Yep. And so
it's crazy.
And then I have a local skateboard shop that does a skateboard camp where they get, you know, and they did it for 3 years before I left the East Coast after graduating high school. So in my junior and senior year, we had the skateboard camp where they would bring all of the best skateboarders from California right. to come skate with us, and all these little kids that would pay for a week. And so this one guy that always sort of believed in me, that owned the skateboard shop, that was the first one to ever give me free anything
right.
And created sort of the local skateboard team, he, you know, he would get these guys and get us all together, and sort of that really developed and encouraged us. And, you know, we saw that, wow, we didn't even know we were good, and we were almost as good as these California pros because we were in such a bubble. And so, you know, him believing, and then he went on to do Burton snowboards and create a shoe company, and now he's one of the highest up people at Nike.
Wow.
And so he's, you know, this guy that was sort of, you know, looked out for me, that was much older
right.
than us, and you know, really encouraged us and sort of, you know, believed in us and helped right. put us in with the people that would, you know, let us have access to that other world of right. California. And
so,
the next
so right then, at the end of high school, life's going really well for you.
Yes.
And things are falling into place, and you're going on these skate tours, I would assume.
Yep. And, you know, and there was some other weird, there was some things, I have like these full circle things that happened in my life, and there was one of them back then in skateboarding, before I get into sort of the pivot away from skateboarding.
Right.
But there was a company, my first skateboard ever was a Santa Cruz skateboard by a guy named Rob Roskopf. And that was the first one that it was a professional skateboard that right. I picked out of the magazine because
right.
I liked the drawing, and my mom bought it for right. Christmas and sort of the whole thing.
Right.
And sort of in my senior year, I was going through different skateboard companies,
right.
Changing from one to another. And, you know, I would be on one and it would sort of lose money and fail. And then I would get picked up by another one. But one weird thing that happened that year when I was, guess I was 17, that senior year, was Rob Roskopf, the guy whose first skateboard I had, mm-hmm. was the team manager of a company called Sims, and he saw that I went on tour with his company and the company I was on. We were sort of at some of the same places, right, so we right. skateboarded together. He found out my company folded, and he reached out to me and sponsored me on this company, Sims. And so it was very strange that sort of the first guy, as a very little kid, that I had this, you know, his professional skateboard, later became a friend
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and team manager for me,
right.
which sort of made everything feel very attainable.
Right.
Because, you know, and then with the Ice-T thing, I just felt like, wow, it's like, well, anything is, you know, anything is possible.
Right.
Here I am thinking, you know, that we're all, you know, not that good or not as good as this mm-hmm. or that. And mm-hmm. like, and then sort of when we get out of our bubble, it's like, wow, we were really focused and like, and very disciplined and right. learning all this stuff and wow. getting good. And so, you know, a lot of the people that I came out of that with went on to become professional skateboarders, right. very famous artists, you know, that guy that went on to work at Nike. And so my sort of original crew of kids all, for one reason or another, went on to do, you know, a lot of great things. Some of them wound up dead, and some of, you know, it was sort of like either went really south or things went really good. But
right. One extreme to the other.
Yeah. But
so
yeah.
when did it start pivotal?
So everything was great, and I racked up all these sponsors. Right. I had free skateboards, free wheels, yeah. the trucks that
were. Were they asking for your autograph too?
At the demonstrations, yeah. I would sign. Yeah, I'd sign autographs and stuff.
That's
and
cool.
So it was. Yeah, it was getting to where, you know,
you were building some type of fame within the skating board community.
Yep. Yeah, and then all my friends were like the next big guys, and you know, I wasn't professional yet. I was still an amateur, but I had all the pieces in place, and everything was in Northern California, which is sort of where the whole industry was. And
right.
I had all the right things. And so, you know, I had spent a summer out there with that company and sort of learned the lay of the land of Northern California and made a bunch of friends. And so when I graduated in 1993 from high school, I was set to move out there and continue the skateboarding with all these sponsors and, you know, progress and do the thing with Ice-T sort of on the side and all that stuff.
On the side.
That's how it was in my mind. And then, you know, I was about a month away from moving there, and I was waiting at a red light and just, you know, sort of staring ahead, waiting for it to turn green. And all of a sudden I got rear-ended by a woman that was had basically no idea that the light was red or that there was a car there for some strange reason.
Right, so you were in a car.
I was in my car, and she hit me going like 30, you know, and I was had my foot on the brake, so it was just sort of, I didn't go anywhere. It was like a big whiplash. And at the time I didn't feel hurt. I didn't think anything was, you know, I didn't think it was that big of a deal.
Okay.
And so...
So you could walk out of the car.
Walked out of the car. I didn't feel anything. You know, next day went skateboarding like I have to get, you know, video footage and sort of do my thing, which was, you know, a horrible idea. Anyone who knows about whiplash is like it takes a day or two before you feel it.
Yeah.
And God forbid you're jumping down 15 stairs, sliding down the handrail 100 times trying to do a trick, you know, while you're sort of... having that happen. But the result of me going skateboarding the next day and having that accident was suddenly I just couldn't walk at all.
So it happened at the skateboard park?
No, it was like I skateboarded that day and did my thing and went home, and then it was like, you know, I started feeling like very strange, sort of numb and, and like, you know, something was wrong. And then when I woke up in the morning, I literally couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't walk. It was like excruciating pain.
So it was like,
overnight.
Like paralyzed or?
Yeah, basically. Like I couldn't, I mean, I had feeling because there was a lot of pain, but nothing was, you know, I couldn't, everything was super tight. It was as if the muscles had just, you know, and so immediately going into MRIs and like, what is wrong with me? This is, you know, this is so strange to not be able to walk and not be able to move my legs properly and all this stuff. And they did all that stuff and never really found, there was no bone, there was no fracture, you know, it was muscle and nerve related.
But it was no head injury or...
They didn't, there was never anything, it was, you know, at the end it was like nerve and muscle related. So like I tore muscles and, you know, and pulled things, which, you know, can take longer to heal sometimes than a fracture. So, and it was, you know, it was really like nothing in the x-rays to show what was wrong. So they didn't really know how to go about fixing it or telling me what to do other than rest.
Did you try to ride the skateboard right after that? Or
No, I mean, all this, I mean, when I say I couldn't walk, it was like.
You did nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I had to have my mom get me, you know, crutches right away, and it was sort of like, you know, and it was just very confusing because I had never had anything, you know, I had broken limbs and broken wrists and ankles and done all the skateboard injuries my whole life and but never had anything like this.
This is deeper.
Yeah.
So as a young kid, you're just ready to move to fulfill this huge dream of yours.
Yep.
And now you're sitting on, standing on crutches in tremendous pain.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me the discouragement that's kicking in now. Was it discouraged?
I mean, it was, and it was also like I wanted to get away from the East Coast. I wanted to get away from a small town. I wanted to be where all my friends were who were 2 or 3 years older than me that were already out there doing their thing. So, I mean, it was beyond discouragement. It was, I couldn't accept it. Wasn't accepting it. And so, you know, my mom was, you know, obviously had supported me my whole life and I had proven, you know, with the freedoms that she gave me, that I was fairly responsible, made good decisions, as far as she knew, you know.
Except the Atlantic City stuff.
I mean, it gets way worse. It gets way worse than any of that.
Okay.
But I won't even get into that. You know, just being a kid with not a lot of money and needing to go places and needing gas money, and you know, we would have all types of schemes and scams and
scams and stuff.
You know.
So it's interesting how you said, "I'm not going to take it. I'm not going to accept."
Yeah.
This disability, or I'm not going to accept this. So I'm assuming you just moved.
Yeah, and it was also sort of like, well, whatever this is, it'll go away. Okay. It wasn't even like that. I was sort of that. I was just like, man, I'm just going to get out there.
Right.
It's going to sort itself out.
Right.
Whatever it is, you know. And then I still had the Ice-T thing. So no matter what, I had, you know, sort of an obligation that I was excited about, and all my friends were there regardless. So it was like, man, I'm going no matter what, and we'll see what happens. And then what happens is. basically it doesn't get better. I do physical therapy every day, and I'm building a court case to sort of pay for all of this. Yeah. Because there was no money in skateboarding back then. Right, they were giving free stuff, but they weren't. It's not like now where where you win an X Games and you get, you know, all this, you know, six figure stuff. It was you know, it was hard to have a living and be a skateboarder. Right. So, you know, all of a sudden this free stuff just stopped coming, and it's sort of like, hey, what can, you're not skating, you can't film, you can't contribute, you can't get an ad in the magazine, you know, what, we can't just keep giving you stuff, and you know, and so it just slowly all went away.
Right.
You know, and I wasn't, you know, really getting better to the point where
you could do something.
And, you know, it's the kind of thing where if you step out of it, it progresses without you. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden there was a whole new batch of tricks and all this stuff that everybody was doing that I was, you know, way a couple years behind on now. So I just started to see it like really drifting away from me.
So now all you have the ice tea thing. Skateboarding is history, right? And there's no way in the world. Yeah, there has to be a realization.
Oh yeah,
it's done.
Yeah, it's done. I can't. You know, I'm in so much pain that I'm just happy to walk and sit, and you know, I'm just grateful to like be pain free more than I'm thinking about, oh, how can I go slam myself around again.
So then all of a sudden, because again, I love the theme where you talk about grace, and I'm not going to accept. Mm-hmm. Accept what's going on. So there's a point of you that said, I'm not going to accept this label. I'm not going to accept this defeat. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try something else.
Yeah, and so that was the beginning of like me realizing that that was over, and then being plugged in with all these professional skateboarders who need skateboard graphics every month and need t-shirt designs and companies that need logos. And then I started getting plugged in with music people. So I was doing album covers and, you know, working with all these rappers and all these people. So I started having this, and I worked on a magazine that became a nationally published magazine. And, you know, I was sort of one of the original people. And so, you know, all I know how to do is graffiti and draw with a pen on paper, you know, and do stuff on a wall. And so I don't have any real practical graphic design knowledge. Okay. And I don't really know how to, I learned computers a little bit. You know, I learned Photoshop, how to scan in a drawing, and that was it, you know, in high school to prepare it for a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And so I had like no computer knowledge, and, you know, I wasn't an amazing person that could draw by any means.
Right.
You know, I was decent and had a graffiti style, but I wasn't like these other people's stuff that I was looking at. So I never, you know, was like, oh, it doesn't matter because I'm this great artist.
Right, right.
That wasn't there at all. I was like, man, all I know how to do besides skateboarding is art. And so let me learn that.
And how do I make a living doing this? So you got spot. So you started doing the drawings for skateboarders and other artists. And then all of a sudden, how did this become a business? How did this work for you?
Well, so then the iced tea thing, right when, oh God, I'll never forget this night, you know, it started going really good, and we were making our own, you know, Timberland boots and our own flannels. I was designing plaid patterns and really doing all this cool, you know, stuff for clothing.
Right.
And then he was on the Arsenio Hall show. I had my first and only sort of, you know, job that before I quit working for other people and having only my own thing.
Okay.
And that was at Urban Outfitters, you know, up in Berkeley, sort of on the main street there.
Okay.
And I remember the day that Ice-T was on Arsenio Hall wearing all of the stuff I had designed.
Oh,
and,
that's cool.
And I remember being like, oh, I get to quit now. Like, now I've made it.
Oh, okay.
And so I get to quit. And so I remember being so happy that I got to tell my boss at Urban Outfitters, like, oh, like, you know, thanks, it's been great, I appreciate everything, but, you know, now, you know, this just happened, and so obviously I'm going to be rich and famous. And so then fast forward a month later, and Ice-T abandons the clothing line and puts all of his money into the gang truce.
Okay.
And putting money into the Blood and Crip gang truce that was happening right then.
Okay.
And it was like, no matter how much, you know, I wanted him to continue the clothing line, and we had, you know, we had all these orders from Japan, and, you know, we were starting to build momentum. It was sort of like, you know, in my heart, I felt like that was what he was doing was the right thing to do.
Right.
Did the world need another clothing line for gangsters, or did the world need, you know, gangsters to come together and stop killing each other?
Yeah.
And so...
So you're thinking, yes, I believe what he's doing. It's powerful.
And so I had to let that whole thing go, yeah, right as I had quit sort of my income, you know, my main income.
Okay.
So then that was the beginning of me starting my own company. And so I was 18, and the Ice-T thing didn't work out. And that same year,
okay,
I went and started my own company with a friend. And that was the year that I told my grandma, listen, I know you had saved a little money for college for me.
Right.
And, you know, I know you've, you know, seen what's happening with my life and all that. But here's the deal. I'm not going to go to college. It's like I've looked into art school and it's super expensive.
Right, right.
And so I want to get a computer so I can start my own business and do my own art school.
Okay.
And so my grandma said yes and gave me like the $4,000 at the time to buy
an Apple Mac computer
that was, you know, made for graphic design or whatever.
Okay, so she gave you your first $5,000 or $4,000 to start your business.
Yep.
So yeah, one computer. What was the business name?
It was called Next Effects.
Okay, Next Effects.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you started this with your buddy.
Yep, and we just immediately would start coloring in our drawings in Photoshop. We would, you know, we figured out how to use a scanner, and we were still just sort of making everything by hand. I was still using Xerox machines and these rub-on transfer letters, and,
right,
you know, I didn't, you know, I still was computer illiterate, and so that was the beginning of me being like, okay, I'm going to learn,
right,
this computer because I'm tired of going to Kinko's. I want to just do it all right here, and I want to be able to get, you know, the clean result that, you know, I get with the, you know, hours with the pen and,
right,
and a ruler and making this. My artwork was always very graphic and very clean and looked like a computer. I had a very steady hand for that. And so it translated to the computer sort of look.
Okay.
And so I was, you know, instantly excited, like, wow, okay, just like martial arts and skateboarding, no coach, no team, just me and this thing.
Right.
And every little filter in Photoshop that would do a different thing was like a trick to me in skateboarding.
Right. Okay.
So I just got that same passion and excitement,
yeah,
and self-discipline of I'm going to learn this.
Right. So you self-taught yourself how to work on the computer, how to do the,
mm-hmm,
do all these graphics and stuff like this. And so now did God kick in? When did the God thing? No, God.
You know, it's because of where I came from. There was always a lot of New Age,
okay,
stuff, you know,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
all my mom's friends were either a Buddhist or a Rasta,
okay,
or a, you know, and all that stuff. So it was, you know, there was definitely like a spiritual component,
right,
to my belief system.
Right.
But I also felt a lot like I'm making all of this happen.
Okay.
Right. So I was under the illusion that, you know, even though this stuff was seemingly, you know, very far-fetched,
right,
and stuff that like no one could ever really make happen, I still sort of felt like, hey, I'm the master of my own destiny.
Correct.
You know, the secret. I've got the secret. I will it and it happens for,
yeah,
me. And I was still sort of under that belief system.
Throw it out there. You throw it out in the universe, it'll come back.
Mm-hmm.
The karma kind of.
Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, I'm trying to do good things,
right,
and I'm helping people and I'm, you know, charitable person and, you know, all these sort of things. So I felt like, yeah, this is, I guess, what comes to people who try to do good.
So when did it get to the point when you go, that secret stuff or that karma stuff is just, you come to a realization, this is not working?
Well, to me, I had that skateboard thing where the first skateboard I had, that guy wound up becoming, you know, a friend,
right,
and a peer,
right,
which is like a weird thing to have an idol sort of then become like a partner or whatever.
That's cool.
But within the art realm, I had another person that was like the epitome of what I thought good was. He was just the best.
Right.
He was the best. You know, he started the Rocksteady breakdancing crew in New York.
Okay.
He was a New York City guy that painted on the subways.
Right.
And he was in all the graffiti books. And his stuff had a metaphysical component to it,
okay,
within his work. So I always liked his stuff because it wasn't just about my name really big. He had,
right,
a message to it.
Right.
And it was sort of, you know, sort of these esoteric teachings or these different things. So I was always drawn to him because he, you know, had the good style and the good color and all that stuff, but he also had like this substance and this message and this deeper thing.
Right.
And so through Ice-T, a couple years into having my company, I became partners with him.
Okay.
So once again, it was sort of like, you know, I set these goals and these dreams and I achieved them, And then I'm sort of like, wow, like I felt like at 18 I had already achieved my dreams.
Right, right.
And so where do you go from there? You create new dreams and stuff, but it's sort of like, wow, that doesn't happen to everybody.
No.
And then for that to happen a second time within my new focus of art, with this guy becoming my partner and best friend and mentor, who was sort of everybody's favorite, and no one could understand why he would choose me. I wasn't that great. He was sort of drawn to me, and nobody, you know, really... we didn't understand why.
Yeah.
And so just more and more of these things that, that lacked explanation, that were, you know, felt like something out of a movie or something I couldn't make up. I just sort of, you know, you just keep wondering, well, what is, you know, what is this synchronicity? What is the meaning of all this? Right. Why am I being smiled on? Why do I get so much grace?
Right.
Why do my catastrophes turn into triumphs? You know, what is this?
Right.
You know, it's, and then the more and more I became older and know yourself, it's like, well, surely it's not me. I just started to realize, you know, what, you know, how much mistakes I made and how flawed I am, and sort of that whole thing where it's like, okay, I can't take credit for any of this. There's something else that's, you know, that's that's allowing this to happen for me. And but I was always feeling like it will stop. It will all stop if I don't keep the faith in the passion and the thing that I believe in. You know, I didn't have a name for it yet. And I knew it wasn't me, but, you know, it was sort of like I always had this faith that became more and more intense, because it was like I would tell people my stories and they'd be like, dude, I've been trying to do what you've been doing my whole life, and I haven't had one thing even close to that level of of success or a door open for me like that or whatever. And, you know, I guess as we continue in this hour-long podcast, my life just is more and more and more and more of those. And so, you know, I stay faithful to a thing, a path and a belief system and a way to treat people and all these things. And I stay positive, and but, you know, it still lacks. There's no explanation for all of this, you know, sort of fate and things that have happened in my life. So it just, the more that they, it was like a case was building within my life, within myself, of, you know, that it's not normal. It's not me. So what is it? And so that was sort of the beginning of trying to put my finger on what it was. And, you know, my parents never talked about religion or God, only in a negative way, you know. And so my relationship to Christianity was such that I felt like, well, a lot of bad things have been done under that banner. I don't know that I want to align myself with that name, you know, that name. But, you know, and the more I looked into... It's funny because before I ever read the Bible, I knew tons of verses and things from the Bible and word from the Bible from reggae songs. Because although Rastafarianism is, you know, has its strange beliefs, such as Haile Selassie being the second coming of Christ, or, you know, other sort of strange things, if you strip some of those away, they read a passage a day, you know, a passage a day, and they're very devout Christians, and they believe in Christ completely, and so their music is filled with verses from the Bible. So as I began to actually read, I realized I already had a lot of these things, you know, sort of already in my head that I, when I heard them in the songs, I felt alignment with. You know, and then to then read them and see the origin of it, you know, I just sort of feeling more and more connected to, you know, the you know, a follower of Jesus's ways more than what I believed a Christian was, you know. I saw those as separate things, you know, back then and almost even still to this day, where, you know, it definitely wasn't encouraged for me to be part of any particular thing by my parents or my friends. It was, so even now, it's, people don't really know where it came from within me, because it was never forced upon me or even really offered to me. I just sort
it's almost like the Lord, the Holy Spirit won't
push me to find meaning in all of this, you know, sort of serendipitous events and symbolic things, and you know.
So if we speed it up in the last couple of years, you have a new business.
Yeah, so that, you know, that business led to me advancing more and more with the computer, and I met more and more, you know, musicians, and more of my friends became famous pro athletes. So I got able to do more and more bigger projects, and, you know, with bigger and bigger brands. And I just never stopped learning on the computer. Once I learned, you know, how to make album covers and logos and these things, right. I pictured them moving.
Right.
So then I started learning how to make them move. And
the
then
graphics move.
Making the graphics move. Somebody told me, hey, dude, you're so good at Photoshop. You've been using it for, you know, 8 or 9 years. There's After Effects, which is Photoshop on wheels. Right. And I was like, oh, my gosh, if I can make all this stuff that I do in Photoshop move. And they're like, you can. So I had a friend sort of teach me that. And now that's what I do, you know, every day professionally and for Hollywood. Right. But it started back in 1999. And so it was sort of the next level of taking it from these static things, T-shirts, things that don't move, to making things move, mixing in music, learning how to film and become a director, learning how to go on set, learning how to be a photographer, learning lensing and lighting and sort of the whole thing, and basically putting myself through film school. You know, I just kept being like, well, if I learn, you know, graphics, then I can learn editing. If I learn editing, I can learn directing. And you know, and I have friends that went to film school and peers, and so everybody would, you know, band together to help me, but it just, the self-teaching mission never stopped. And so it took me back to the East Coast. Once I started making things move good in 1999, I moved to New York and lived there until 2003. And there I really learned all kinds of stuff and got involved in big projects. And all that was going really great. And then 9/11 happened. And all of a sudden that whole industry just sort of got put on pause. Like all the, you know, I was working for the Four Seasons, but even as rich as they are, they put a halt on the, you know, the projects that we were doing for them at that company. So all of a sudden I sort of reverted back to what I knew when I worked for the Wu-Tang Clan, which is a rap group in Staten Island, New York, and I lived in Brooklyn, sort of close to them. So I stopped doing all that and focused on sort of doing this clothing line and skateboard graphics and sort of what I used to do. And through that, I got involved with the original guy that first sponsored me in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and he plugged me in with another friend that was making a documentary movie about skateboarding and rap music and sort of how the two cultures overlap. And so he was in Venice, California, and so part of the production was happening in New York, and they would come and we would interview people there and work on the movie there. But then I would go to California, and especially in the winter, and get away from the snow and work on this project there. And it was staying with the director of that film a block from Venice Beach at his house, where he had a barbecue one night, and I met my wife. And so Jennifer, my wife Jennifer. Yeah, and you know, fell in love at first sight. And then, you know, we kind of became inseparable immediately. And even though I had stuff going on in New York, you know, 9/11 had sort of taken away a lot of the opportunity for the animation and editing stuff that I was doing there. So once, you know, I told her, like, listen, you know, we should move in together. Do you want to move to New York? And she was like, no way. I hate the snow. There's too much trash. It's too loud. She was going to fashion school at the time, and so she didn't want to leave school. And so I said, you know what? Like, things in New York kind of, like, I don't know when they're going to pick back up from what's happened there. But in California, there's, you know, plenty of opportunity. And so I packed up all my stuff and moved out here and moved in with her. And then,
so when did you get married?
I got married in 2007. Yeah, and so I proposed to her, I think, 2 years after we had lived together.
You went out to your 10th anniversary.
Yeah, we had actually. We had our 10th anniversary.
Cool. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. So, yeah, so I met her and moved out here, and that was 2003. And she encouraged me to do, to get away from sort of that community that I had fallen back in with of rappers and skateboarders, and get back into the high-end animation and sort of bigger things. And, you know, and it's like, it's very easy to work for my friends, you know, and stay in my comfort zone and you know, and all that stuff. But she really pushed me to continue striving and taking it to the next level. And so it was out here that I really, really, you know, put in another major effort to learn, you know, the animation and editing and directing and stuff that I do now. And
so you work with big names now.
And, you know, I had a really lucky, I mean, I don't believe in luck. I just feel like my whole thing is blessed. And so always sort of, you know, cognizant of being blessed and that it's not luck, that I'm being smiled on, and that I'm here to do something, you know, that I'm doing it or yet to do it, but it's for a reason, and it's, you know, it's for the work of God. And so, you know, I just keep having these things where I work for a friend's company and we wind up doing a DreamWorks thing. And then that DreamWorks thing winds up getting a lot of press. You know, I did Kung Fu Panda 2, the end credits. And so, you know, and then through that same friend, I worked on a bunch of HBO shows where I do the main title, which is, you know, the intro to the show. Okay. And, where you introduce the characters and the actors and sort of show a context of what the show is going to be about.
Right.
And through those, I got two Emmy nominations, one for The Newsroom and one for Too Big to Fail. And so, yeah, I you know, I get put on projects through blessings that wind up, you know, leading to sort of big accolades or other big opportunities.
Right.
And then I've become more and more...
It's 2 o'clock.
Sorry.
I've become more and more, you know, engaged with Snoop Dogg and working on his projects, and through him I, you know, get to work with Martha Stewart or Seth Rogen or sort of these other more mainstream people. And so, yeah, I've had an amazing time out here of continuing to follow the same dream, which is I've been given a gift for God only knows why, and it's a gift that has to do with vision and artwork and visuals. And so I just continue to try to hone it and put it forth and work on projects that I believe in, that I think will be good for humanity or society, or, you know, that's not always the case. I work on Nike golf commercials, where I don't know, you know, how that's benefiting the kingdom of God.
But one thing that I'm fascinated with, because you have a heart for the African-American culture and what they've gone through. And I noticed that even you donated some time to do a political commercial back in August for who?
That was with Killer Mike, who's a rapper, with Bernie Sanders, who was the only candidate that I really felt like I could get behind. And that's one of the things that I enjoy from the blessing of my career now, is that I get to do, you know, a golf commercial that pays me a lot of money that doesn't really do anything towards where my heart really lies, which is, you know, in basically, you know, emancipation of everybody from mental slavery and oppression and sort of all these things. And so I always have believed that art without, you know, activism is empty, and that all my personal art always takes on a lot of meaning. And so I want to convey messages and teach people. And so I believe in edutainment, edutainment. I feel like you can
education and entertainment.
I feel like that's not mine. I stole that from the rapper Karis one. But it's, you know, it would be very empty for me if I was just doing these commercials and never putting my time into things I believe in. So through making money on those, I'm able to donate time to, my friend made an amazing documentary about music in Mali, West Africa, and about the Manding culture and Malian culture, and, you know, the history of creating rock and roll and blues music and the pentatonic scale and all this amazing stuff that people don't know about. And so I feel like Robin Hood, where I want to take from these big corporations and do these jobs that feel kind of empty and soulless, and then take my time and my talents that God blessed me with and use them for things I believe in.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too. Before the podcast, I asked Corey, I said, look, I want to use your profile picture to put it up on the podcast. And your profile picture was just black.
Right.
And so explain. So I can't put a black, I guess I could. It matters. What if the black thing that I did on the podcast? So I asked you, why in the world is your profile picture just one black picture? And what did you tell me?
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody expects it to be some colorful thing, or, you know, I like to make beautiful things, photographs and paintings and art. And so for me, you know, I've always been heavily connected. My family, my friends, which are my family and became to me my blood family, have always been black and Puerto Rican and, you know, all in Latino right. and Asian and, you know, from all over the place, you right. know. And so my family's always been that mixed. And now my actual family, my wife is Peruvian. Her sister married a black man, so their children are mixed. Right. Her other sister married a Mexican man. And so, you know, we have, like, this very mixed family out here. And my friends have always been very diversified. Yeah. And you know, so for me, I've always been fighting for my friends.
Okay.
And so whichever group is, you know, sort of being oppressed at the time right. or needs, you know, some sort of visual, I've always wanted to offer it. I believe right. in artivism, right. right? Which is that if I'm given a gift, that my art should be able to be used for right. activism
right.
and, you know, towards a goal that we believe in. And so my profile picture went black when the first sort of string of police shooting young black children began, and I had every intention of, you know, and it was like a solidarity thing of just feeling like, man, you know, we don't get to see anything beautiful right now. I'm right. taking the beauty off yeah. of my page right. because until there's some beauty in the world, I feel like I feel strange.
Right.
You know, I feel even slightly hypocritical putting something like a graffiti picture or right. just some sort of art
yeah.
because to me there's like, you know, if anyone's looking at me and cares what I think, let me tell them.
Right.
And so I made it black then thinking it would, you know, go back to being whatever me or, you know, mm. art or whatever after a couple months. But, you know, I basically felt like I'm not taking it off until that stops.
Yeah.
And from, you know, that was a couple years ago, and it's just never stopped.
Never stopped.
Yeah, every couple months there's a new instance of that. And
right.
for me, that's just something that, you know, I have my godson and my nephew. They look like these kids that are mm-hmm. being killed for no reason yeah. sometimes. So for me, it's a, you know, it's a huge deal. And
okay.
and that being a visual artist and having a black page makes a statement that makes people ask the question, which creates the dialogue right. of me being able
which
to explain.
Which I asked the question.
Yeah, so that's, you know, yeah. that's sort of the purpose of, like, that's my anti-art that creates dialogue.
Right, right.
If I can't create art that I feel is powerful enough, then yeah. being an artist and removing and having a black image right. is its own sort of statement right. in a way where it's like, hey, you know, okay. you're going to lose all your artists in a minute if we don't get some, you know, right. accountability and justice going on in the world. We're all going to stop making art. Then you'll have nothing to look at. Yeah.
No, I appreciate John. I was going through this podcast. I'm thinking, I got to do another one because there's so much information, but our time's winding up. But thank you, Corey.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, I think, just to sum it up, I feel like, you know, I went from believing that I was manifesting all these amazing, miraculous things in my own life
right.
to then, you know, God drawing me into him and me instantly having a understanding of my divine connection yeah. and how all of these things that are great that are happening in my life are through him, and that I'm supposed to be doing a service
right.
to that which right. is giving, you know, to me and providing this amazing career and life for me
right.
and it's been a slow, steady path of me understanding who Jesus is, because that doesn't come without reading.
Yeah,
there's no in, you know
right.
divine nature and God, you know, and that is something that is felt, and I've always had this intense faith
right.
and I could never describe it or yeah. put words to it
yeah.
but, you know, so through coming here I've actually learned the actual word, you know, and gotten more into some of the specifics of learning about Jesus. And, you know, I have a strange path in that I felt the faith and the intuition and the realization that all of this was very real
mm-hmm.
before I even knew, you know, sort of put the words on, yeah. on it. So,
no, it's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And yeah, thanks for being a church that I can...
This funky little church of ours.
can accept a guy like me and, you know, have someone who does, you know, things for Snoop Dogg, but the next day I do something for Sesame Street.
Yeah.
So at least I have a, you know, an interesting dichotomy of work going on.
No, I think it's great. And it would be great to interview your wife, too, because she has a whole nother story.
Absolutely. And yeah, coming from a Peruvian culture of Catholicism and,
oh, yeah.
you know, she has all kinds of interesting ways of how she came yeah. here and
so
found this path
too. Get Jennifer in her as well.
That would be amazing.
But anyway, thanks for listening. And remember, this Sunday is the last Sunday that we're going to have three services. So if you want to join us this Sunday at 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, and 10:45. And then the following week, because I made this big decision to go down to one service starting March 5th. And so we'll have a 10 a.m. service. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And remember, every day is a gift from God. use it wisely. And join us next week for another outstanding podcast. God bless you. I'll see you next week.
Thanks.
You feel good about it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I felt like just had a normal conversation. It's probably too long. How long are you doing?
Well, this one's long.